This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January 28, 2004, from Woodstock, New York, and Lipa Fernandez. David Kaye tells the Senate that the pre-war invasion intelligence on Iraq, including his own, was wrong. British Prime Minister Tony Blair is officially cleared of exaggerating evidence in the events leading up to the war in Iraq. And California's governor continues his attacks on public education. Now he's going after Labour researchers. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Jackson Allers, and these are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
After winning the New Hampshire primary yesterday, presidential candidate John Kerry heads into next week's round of seven Democratic state contests, riding a wave of momentum he hopes will carry over, both in terms of increasing his campaign coffers and increasing his popularity in the South. The upcoming primary in South Carolina will be the first in a state with a large black population, and job losses are a major issue. Party officials expect blacks will account for up to 40% of voters. South Carolina Representative Jim Clyburn, a six-term Democratic congressman and the dominant black politician in his state, intends to endorse Kerry, something political analysts say could be important for Kerry in southern states. For North Carolina Senator John Edwards, South Carolina is a must-win primary. Edwards, a native son of South Carolina, and General Wesley Clark, who has Arkansas roots, are banking on their southern heritage to gain votes. At least 16 people were killed in Iraq in the last 24 hours, Raphael Croft reports from Baghdad.
This morning, a suicide bomber driving a van disguised as an ambulance blew up his vehicle in front of a hotel frequented by Westerners in central Baghdad. Four Iraqis were killed, according to the Iraqi police. This bomb attack followed one of the bloodiest days in recent weeks in Iraq. Six U.S. soldiers were killed in two separate attacks near Baghdad. South of the capital, two Iraqis working for CNN were shot and killed while returning from an assignment. Three Iraqi gunmen were shot dead by U.S. troops in northern Iraq. In his meeting with French President Jacques Chirac yesterday in Paris, Kofi Annan said the United Nations' main concern for sending experts to Iraq was security. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Baghdad.
The Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Korey held talks today with United States Middle East envoy John Wolfe. Hours before the meeting, the Israeli army carried out one of its largest raids into Gaza City in months. Mohamed Ghalini reports from Gaza City.
As many as 13 Palestinians were killed today in an Israeli army incursion into the Zaytun neighborhood southeast of Gaza City. According to Israeli army sources, the raid was in response to the firing of mortars and improvised rockets at the illegal Jewish settlement of Netzarim, south of Gaza City. Eyewitnesses said the incursion started when Israeli tanks and bulldozers advanced from Netzarim. Resistance activists then rushed to confront the vehicles, but they were shot at by an Israeli force hiding in the nearby streets. This was followed by several hours of confrontation between the Israeli tanks and armored vehicles, and Palestinians armed with assault rifles, rocket-propelled grenades, and improvised explosives. Palestinian fighters reportedly put an Israeli tank and armored bulldozer out of action. Five of the dead Palestinians belonged to resistance groups. The rest were uninvolved in any military activities. A Palestinian paramedic was also wounded during the incursion. Mohamed Ghalayini, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
The Department of Justice is reporting that there have been no civil rights violations since the adoption of the Patriot Act. Scarlett Office has more from D.C.
In a report released to Congress on Tuesday, the Justice Department's Inspector General, Glenn Fine, claims to have found no instances in which the Patriot Act has been used to abuse civil rights. Opponents of this act are pointing to seemingly contradictory reports released by the Office of the Inspector in June 2003 and December 2003. Fine documents over 1,200 civil rights complaints that were received in a six-month period last year. Michael Rettner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, is concerned that this discrimination is not being acknowledged.
Every American ought to be concerned by the fact that our Department of Justice is essentially treating Arabs and people from the Muslim religion in a fashion that's different than human beings, and that has been trying to deny it at the same time.
President Bush is certain to face major opposition in his battle to renew the act, which is set to expire in 2005.
The African Union has established a human rights court for Africa, but it is unclear if the court would be effective in reducing human rights violations on the continent. Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
The Human Rights Court was established following its ratification by the African Union. The Human Rights Court is supposed to address cases of human rights abuses in Africa, the worst of these human rights violations have occurred in countries like Nigeria, Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola, where large multinational companies are exploiting natural resources. These countries are not known to respect international instruments on the protection of human rights. Observers say such records may hamper the African Union's attempt to protect human rights on the continent. The host country for the Human Rights Court and the judges will be appointed during the African Union's General Assembly in July. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
And I'm Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, former CIA weapons inspector in Iraq, David Kay, testified to two Senate committees. He told the committees that the pre-war invasion intelligence on Iraq, including his own, was wrong. Kay, who testified in Congress during the build-up to the invasion, telling lawmakers that Saddam Hussein was a threat, now says an independent team should investigate what went wrong with the intelligence gathering. He warns, however, it should not be a witch hunt on the Bush administration, and that he still thinks the invasion of Iraq was the right thing to do. Republican lawmakers continued to deny the Democrats' request to investigate whether the White House dubiously manipulated the information to justify the war. Our D.C. editor Mitch Jeserich reports.
Let me begin by saying we were almost all wrong, and I certainly include myself here. My view was that the best evidence that I had seen was that Iraq indeed had weapons of mass destruction.
Former head of the U.S. Weapons Inspection Team in Iraq, David Kay, who stepped down last week, testified to the Senate Armed Service Committee that he is almost certain that the U.S. will not find large stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. Kay says the pre-invasion intelligence failure is due to inadequate gathering of information and not due to a White House ploy to manipulate the information to justify war.
Not in a single case was the explanation, I was pressured to do this, that I am convinced that at least of the analysts I dealt with, I did not come across a single one that felt it had been, in the military term, inappropriate command influence.
Last week, Vice President Dick Cheney said that two trailers were found in Iraq that gave conclusive evidence that Saddam Hussein had programs for weapons of mass destruction. Kay says he disagrees with that assertion, and he answered questions about it put to him by Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan.
Do you know what intelligence Vice President Cheney was relying on 1 week ago when he made that statement to the American people? I'm talking about right now. You've said the consensus in the intelligence community is that those vans are not related. Is that a correct statement, which you just gave here this morning? Is that the consensus opinion in the intelligence community now?
It is my view of the consensus opinion, but there are no doubt, given the nature of opinions, people out there who hold a different opinion.
All right. Now, we've got to find out what the basis, it seems to me, of that statement is. And I would ask the chairman that we ask the vice president for the basis of that statement.
Throughout 2002, several Bush administration departments reportedly told President Bush that Iraq did not have nuclear weapons. Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy questions David Kay, who is a strong proponent of invading Iraq, why that information wasn't more prevalent.
Can you give us any explanation of why these agencies, in retrospect, appear to have had it right, and the information that the administration used appeared to have it wrong?
If you read the total body of intelligence in the last 12 to 15 years that flowed on Iraq, I quite frankly think it would be hard to come to a conclusion other than Iraq was a gathering serious threat to the world with regard to WMD.
Gathering serious threat. Do you really think that those are the words that brought us to war?
Senator, that's probably far more in your realm than in my realm. I'll take Senator McCain's defense of I being a knave in the world of politics.
Though Kay doesn't want to reflect on politics, he's eager to talk about Saddam Hussein's psychology. When Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama asked him this.
Dr. Kay, your view is that Saddam Hussein, in his own mind, had expansionistic intentions with regard to the world, and that he felt that the possession or threat of weapons of mass destruction enhanced that ability to be a powerful force in the region.
Absolutely right, Senator. I think he, both in the region and he thought of them as a potential weapon to use against his own citizens.
Democratic lawmakers accuse the Republican leadership on the Senate Intelligence Committee in its investigation of ignoring the White House's role in the failure of pre-war intelligence. Republican chair of the committee, Pat Roberts of Kansas, says there is no evidence of any wrongdoing by the White House. Imad Khaduri is a former nuclear scientist in Iraq who worked on Iraq's pre-1990 nuclear weapons program and is the author of the book called Iraq's Nuclear Mirage. He says David Kaye, who was influential in selling the story that Iraq had the prohibitive weapons, should have known differently from his time working as a UN inspector in Iraq during the 90s.
Since he's been there firsthand, he should have had much better intelligence in both senses of the word, as intelligence and his intelligence that Iraq had as far as the nuclear weapon program has ceased. He kept reiterating what the other Iraqi scientist, Khazar Hamza, was saying on Capitol Hill to the congressional committees. Iraq was within 1 year or 2 years of a nuclear bomb. And this is all false. This is all lies. This is all misinformation. They were just whipping up the drive toward the occupation of Iraq. And this is a criminal act, a war criminal act. And he should be tried for that.
Now that Kay is coming out and saying that Iraq did not have the weapons, and he's saying that there's a problem with the intelligence agencies, do you see this as a good thing?
Now, this guy, after spending $900 million of American taxpayers' money, is saying the obvious. What, I should pat him on the back? And he's saying, well, it's not really Bush's fault, it's the intelligence fault. Well, it's his fault. He was part of intelligence, he was part of the CIA. He should have used his mind and his intelligence, not after the occupation and the death of 500 American soldiers and 10,000 Iraqi civilians. What good is it now?
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
Meanwhile, in the UK, while many anticipated that this would be British Prime Minister Tony Blair's toughest week in politics, the release of the Hutton Inquiry report today officially cleared him of any exaggeration of evidence in the events leading up to the war in Iraq. However, as Naomi Fowler reports from London, some members of Parliament are not surprised that the report clears Blair and, in fact, are calling for a new and independent inquiry.
The mandate of the inquiry was to investigate the circumstances surrounding the death of weapons of mass destruction expert Dr. David Kelly. Dr. Kelly allegedly committed suicide after anonymously leaking his view to the BBC that the government's claim that Saddam Hussein had the capacity to launch a chemical weapons attack in 45 minutes was without foundation. Dr. Kelly was found dead shortly after being outed as the source for the BBC's story. The events leading to Kelly's death are linked to the handling of the information process by Tony Blair and his government in the lead-up to the invasion in Iraq. It should have been an unusual opportunity for a judicial inquiry to investigate and analyse political and ethical issues and make recommendations about culpability. But the inquiry has raised more questions than it's answered.
It's exactly the whitewash, the establishment cover-up that we predicted it would be.
George Galloway MP, who was expelled from Blair's Labour Party last year.
It has strengthened the case for a completely independent and full judicial inquiry, not into the death of one man, Dr. David Kelly, but into the deaths of 10 or 15, maybe 20,000 men, women and children in Iraq, all based on a lie.
Lindsay German is the national convener of the Stop the War Coalition. They're joining calls for an independent inquiry and today released a report on the Hutton inquiry and the questions that weren't asked.
Where are the weapons of mass destruction? What intelligence did they actually have? When did Tony Blair make the decision with George Bush to go to war? And why are we continuing to occupy a country where people are resisting and demonstrating against America and Britain on a daily basis? I think those are all the serious questions about this war, and none of these have been answered today. I think there should be a full public inquiry, but I also think the evidence that we now know, both from Hutton, but more importantly from outside, points to the fact that Tony Blair lied. He's the only person probably in the world who still believes there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and I think that people will think nothing short of his resignation will be enough.
But Tony Blair is not about to resign or apologise, and the political opposition hasn't been provided with the ammunition it had hoped for. Whether the UK government sexed up the report on Iraq or not, it now seems clear that Iraq posed no imminent threat to the UK or the US, and calls for a wider inquiry into the reasons for going into war are growing. Helen John of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament.
It shows again that, you know, what we consider to be a democratic process is very flawed. And what really still has to keep in fresh in our minds is that we still hold a first strike nuclear policy, and so does the United States. And a lot more pressure has to be brought on these governments to honour their obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and start to dismantle their own nuclear arms. They cannot continually talk about other people's weapons of mass destruction while they go on holding the largest arsenals in the world.
Despite a recent formal request to the International Criminal Court to investigate Tony Blair for war crimes, and a damning Human Rights Watch report released yesterday saying that the official reasons given for going to war in Iraq are unjustifiable, Tony Blair, like many prime ministers before him, seems untouchable. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Schools in Thailand's deep south have closed temporarily after three Buddhist monks and at least one Buddhist police officer were killed. This is the second wave of attacks to hit Thailand's southernmost provinces since the new year. Earlier attacks had targeted government facilities and police stations. FSRN reporter Dwali Saikau Tao has this report from Thailand's southernmost province.
On a sunny afternoon in Narathiwat, 23-year-old Wani is busy helping her mother serve lunch at their streetside restaurant. The eatery caters to Muslim Thais, who are the majority here in the south, making up about 10% of Thailand's 63 million population. Wani says Narathiwat is a beautiful place to live, but when jobs are scarce, she said, people get angry, and that's when the ugly side of the city comes out. Three provinces, including Narathiwat, are still under martial law because of rising violence. Wani says people have locked themselves into their homes and are afraid to come out. Street vendors say they have lost as much as 70% of their income. The violence has also kept tourists away, with hotels seeing some cancellations. Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat blamed the latest killings on separatists trying to provoke religious conflict between Muslims and Buddhists. He said he wouldn't let one square inch of Thailand be separated from the country. In his weekly radio address, he said he was also concerned that Muslim Thais were not providing authorities with useful information. Abdul Rahman Abdul Samad is chairman of the Narathiwat Islamic Committee. When asked about Muslim radicals or separatists who might want an independent Islamic state, Samad shrugged off the question. The old ways are diminishing, and attacks like these are uncommon, he said. Samad did not identify any groups or individuals responsible for the violence, but he said he is hopeful that the government is doing all it can to prevent future attacks. Samad adds that the violence is not linked to JI or Jamaat Islamiyah, Southeast Asia's alleged terror network. JI has been blamed for the Bali nightclub bombings and the hotel bombings in Jakarta. It has nothing to do with it, nothing at all, he says. But the Thai government hasn't ruled out any links to international terrorist groups. It has asked both Malaysia and Indonesia for cooperation, especially along its porous borders. Locals remain baffled as to who is behind the violence. Many said they simply don't know who to trust. One angry resident said she was more concerned about the economy than terrorists. A Muslim businessman said the Thai government may even be behind the army raid, in which armed men killed four soldiers and took off with more than 100 weapons. At about the same time, dozens of schools were torched. Supasini Bin Samai is the mother of three kids and teaches at Muang Narathiwat, one of 21 schools burned.
The students were in tears. They felt very bad, but I told them not to give up, that the school would be rebuilt.
She said whoever was involved might be unhappy about the local economy.
Their problem is with the government. For the last 10 or 20 years, the government has been unable to provide jobs, solve drug addictions, and help in local security matters.
Thaksin wants to change this. He said the South will be very different in 5 years, promising economic development aid. But critics say his CEO theory will not work down South. One Buddhist resident said the South is unlike any other parts of Thailand. If the government is sincere, she said, then politicians should be more knowledgeable about the South's culture, politics, and people. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dwahli Saikautau in Narathiwat, Thailand.
Recently, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger used emergency powers to cut funding mid-fiscal year for the Labor Research Institute at the University of California. In his budget address this month, he proposed cutting all funding to the programs for next fiscal year. Labor activists say big business and conservative think tanks have been working for years to do away with the three-year-old programs which examine the role of working people in society. Conservative commentators say labor research programs use taxpayer money to front for big labor issues. FSRN's Max Pringle reports from Pacifica Station at KPFA in Berkeley.
Officials at the $4 million Institute for Labor and Employment at UCLA and UC Berkeley say ILE opponents have had it in for the Institute since its inception in 2000. They say the effort to get rid of the Institute picked up steam last summer as the recall campaign to oust former Governor Gray Davis and elect Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger got underway. Peter Olney is Associate Director of the Institute for Labor and Employment at the University of California. He says corporate interests and related policy groups saw Governor Schwarzenegger's election as a golden opportunity to achieve their goals.
We know that the Institute for Labor and Employment has been in the crosshairs of the Association of Building Contractors and Anti-Union Association of Non-Union Building Construction Companies, and of right-wing think tanks like the Manhattan Institute in New York and the Pacific Research Institute, its counterpart here in California. They've been calling for the elimination of the Institute for Labor and Employment since the summer of 2003, so even prior to the recall.
But critics of the ILE say its activities at the university aren't in keeping with the UC's academic mission. Matt Cox is a public policy fellow in education studies at the Pacific Research Institute in San Francisco.
I do know that the Institute for Labor Economics, a lot of people considered that not really a primary function of the UC system, which would be undergraduate and graduate education, but the mission of that, I think, was suspect to a lot of people.
Labor studies proponents say that suspect mission included research useful in recent living wage and minimum wage campaigns, as well as tracking the impact of immigrant labor in the state. The Institute for Labor and Employment's Peter Olney asked why the ILE's opponents don't feel that business schools and economics departments, who are often pro-corporate, don't come in for the same kind of scrutiny from labor studies detractors. Olney says recent public testimony from a Schwarzenegger administration official may give some clues as to the opponent's agenda.
At a hearing of the Subcommittee on Higher Education of the Senate Budget Committee in Sacramento, Senator Jack Scott, who chairs that committee, asked a representative of the Department of Finance and the Schwarzenegger administration why they had targeted the Institute for Labor and Employment for complete elimination, he said, quote, "We feel that any research that doesn't support fostering a better business climate," unquote, in California is not essential and not necessary and can be cut.
Olney adds that the institutes have been under almost constant assault since they began. For example, he says former Governor Davis cut two-thirds of the ILE's funding in recent years. For his part, Governor Schwarzenegger has called for cutting all ILE funding in his budget for fiscal 2004-2005. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in Berkeley.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. UNICEF issued a report last week claiming that the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Alam, or the LTTE, in Sri Lanka maintain over 700 child soldiers in their rebel military force. The report alleges an increase in recruitment, undermining a plan set up between the rebels and the international community. In an exclusive interview with FSRN, the LTTE top political leader admitted the numbers may be correct, but he said there's no need to recruit children, as a ceasefire agreement between the rebels and the government has shifted the LTTE focus to diplomacy. Yet, as our correspondent Miles Ashdown reports, the LTTE leader says it's better to have child soldiers than street children.
SP Tamil Selvan went on to say that it's essentially a social problem, resulting from the brutal two-decade-long civil war, a war that has taken the lives of 65,000 Sri Lankans. Nearly one-third were children.
When the children find that their relatives, their parents, their sisters, their brothers were taken away by the Sri Lankan military and killed, raped, molested, all these things make the children very adamant and lead them to enter the fighting mechanism, because it is the only place where they get refuge and can work for their motherland.
The LTT says it adheres very strictly to an age restriction, limiting military training to people above 18 years old. However, Tamil Selvan admits birth certificates are not a prerequisite to joining the rebel forces. Yet he says he's aware that many children lie about their age. UNICEF, meanwhile, received hundreds of birth certificates from parents. They found children as young as 10 were abducted, and continue to serve to this day. UNICEF's Ted Scheibon says progress is being made, but there's much more to be done.
We are in a state of no war, no peace. There's a peace process, there's a transition, and I think both parties have repeatedly committed themselves to the ceasefire and to moving towards a situation of peace. This should in no way involve children.
The LTT claims to have proof that some birth certificates are forged. Tamil Selvan says some children in question also dispute their parents' claim. UNICEF agrees that there are undoubtedly some cases where this has been done, but Scheibon says it's not a numbers game.
At the end of the day, it's not about whether it's 1301 or 1295. It's essentially about children, and every case counts. And every single child who is not fulfilling their maximum potential, who's not at school, who's not with their family, belongs there.
The rebels and UNICEF agreed on an action plan, detailing a process of removing child soldiers from the military. But the results of UNICEF's recent study may have severe implications on reconstruction aid. Japan's special representative to Sri Lanka, Yasushi Akashi, co-chaired a conference in the country's capital Friday about rebuilding the war-torn island. Over 20 international delegates, he said, discussed the issue of child soldiers.
That is one of the factors which is weighed by the donor organizations and countries in the process of delivering their assistance. It is a negative factor. Child recruitment has to be stopped.
Tamil Selvan denies the need to recruit child soldiers, saying that since the fighting is over for now, his focus is on political work. But he says he can't turn the children away from joining, as they have no place to go and no one to help them.
Those children are going to be the future citizens of this country. If we are not interested in the welfare of their children, there will be no one interested in their future.
So far, the LTT claims to have released nearly 800 children after investigation. Centers in rebel-controlled Kilinochi facilitate their transfer from the military back to their former lives. Save the Children helps with this process. The organization's program director, Greg Dooley, says their concern is for the child's development.
It's better for the child to be in school. It's better for the child to be developing skills, social skills, as well as academic or technical skills, so that they can become productive citizens in society.
Dooley says the child soldiers are, for the most part, involved in administrative duties. He adds that the action plan has provided a great way for the LTT and the international community to talk. Both parties say they're committed to working out the $14 million action plan. But Tamil Selvan says it's a complicated situation, and changes can't happen overnight. From Sri Lanka, I'm Miles Ashdown for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.